really very stimulating exciting talk. Can you comment on what you think the valences are and the differences are between terrors of the earth and unpublished virtues of the earth, if I got the Cordelia phrase correctly? Are terror and virtue there cognates as well as opposites? Or are they, have you, what is the virtue discourse concerning the earth?
I confess, I think I'd read them as opposites, as this being the thing that Lear is wishing on his elder daughters when he finds that the reverse is true in terms of the love that they professed for him and then the way that they actually treat him. Whereas for Cordelia, it's the reverse, that although she'd refused to proclaim the love in those terms, she's saying actually there's something more kind of fundamentally rooted that is actually being shown as, and that's kind of, I mean, in a sense, that's the reverse of that relation. So I had actually read them as opposites. But that's an interesting
that's
thought.
Right. I mean, I'm just wondering if I'm
whether there's something else that's going on there. I guess I'd have to think about that to try to work out what that might be. I mean, the kind of the obvious immediate thought is, you know, how does virtue relate to, say, Machiavelli,
that's
where
the,
it has different kind of resonances. Where do I start, please?
Yes, I also thought that it was an extraordinarily illuminating paper. The way I understood you, at least your tendency, was that the term earth is, so to speak, the anachronic trace we are looking for. I mean, I was interested in the framing question rather than in many other respects, but exactly in the same sense in which territory marks a certain surfacing, historical and so on, interesting to date, compared to this, earth is somehow the anachronicity which makes the tragedy, maybe, but that is now my question, whether the earth is more significant for the folio or whether it is not.
No, that's interesting. My sense is that that's not where the fracture between those two editions is happening in terms of the question of Earth. And, I mean, the reason I find Earth interesting in part is because it's a return to an older lineage of a kind of a land politics, an Earth politics. And for me, Beowulf is an interesting text on that basis, and that there's a rootedness in the... Indeed, yeah, the Anglo-Saxon Germanic roots of the English language, whereas territory, of course, and what's interesting about territory is that the Latin term territory forms the root of the word territory in most European languages, even ones that don't have a Latin lineage, which is an interesting one. I mean, Danish and Finnish use the Latin-based term for territory, which kind of means that you can actually trace a conceptual history of it through the Latin roots quite specifically in a way that if that term was used with different linguistic roots in different European languages, and this is a largely European project in terms of my own interest. So Earth is interesting because it has a different lineage and it implies different things, as does land. This is why there's that point of kind of territory which only appears in that one instance, in one edition of the play, and only in that first scene. Can you think of that as the kind of a foreign influence, and that once that's divided and abandoned, you fall back into an older, more positively English, British way of thinking about the kind of, what I'm calling here, the geopolitics, the politics of Earth in the play. So, I mean, I think that's interesting. I don't know quite how far that would work and how consistent that reading could become.
Yeah, I would like to follow this. You have now, I mean, very cunningly, I think that's really important, reduced the Earth, so to speak, to the older layer.
To the
older layer.
Okay.
Prehistoric or whatever. But the point would be now more to use anachronic in a sense not of being not in step with a specific time, but rather as the sort of underlying force which still reorganizes or keeps being alive. So as something that survives in a certain sense as a force which either is averse or is productive. And that is a, in this case, it looks as if it was rather a melancholy use of that term in Lear. I'm not sure, but it could be turned around. I'm not sure. I don't have it in mind. So,
I'm not sure that I can answer that question, and the anachronic is kind of forcing me outside of the comfort, in a sense, of where I am with these. I mean, I suppose the way that Earth seems to be used is to a natural elemental sense, whereas territory is very much the human imposition on top of. And I think that makes sense in terms of the kind of conceptual history of territory. That territory emerges as something which is superimposed over already existing land relations, because land relations long predate territory, which is why I think the narrowly economic reading of territory doesn't work. You know, feudalism, for instance, or the Middle Ages generally, which puts all that emphasis on property and land relations relating to the politics of the time, doesn't, to me, explain territory. So the relation there between earth and territory, I think, is an interesting one, and there's perhaps a tension there, but I'm slightly wary of pushing that too far because I haven't thought about it in those terms. Daniel? Nick? Daniel.
I just kind of, so may I follow up? It's risk being a slightly silly question. I kept wondering what the fourth sort of geopolitical term, which is globe, includes in the globe theater. And I guess that took, I mean, one of the things you seem to be implying is that the spatial politics can't be, on this scale, can't be represented directly. I mean, one's to think in terms of sort of like sort of stereotype Aristotelian drama, sort of unity of place. There's all these scenes and kind of visualizable unity of place, you know, which would seem to tie this question of the stage as a globe. So scenes then, I think, this sense of the plot is kind of displaced to this sort of, this territorial plot is displaced to this sort of, you know, at the level of these signifiers that are dispersed through and have a kind of allegory on the level of just how the terms work. It's like what you're saying in a way, almost that land and earth, the sort of Anglo-Saxon etymology almost become self-illustrative as kind of telluric or autochthonous terms themselves. So the earth emerges from the earth as far as territory is kind of foreign term. So if the part of the sort of way place imagining space, so this kind of philological problem kind of repeats or allegorizes the territorial problem. And I'm just wondering how to think about this, also since really it's a problem of staging. What can be staged and how space gets staged? It seems to have to be in this kind of other displaced register, can't be visualized per se.
I don't think I can talk about the staging
aspect
of it. I mean, I'm wary of pushing too hard on this idea that territory is this one intrusion into the play of that, and that it's the foreign imposition over the more kind of rooted, archaic, autochthonous sense of these terms. Because I don't think that would work if you were to extend that to other plays of Shakespeare's. I don't get that sense that you could make that reading of, say, Coriolanus or Richard II around those terms. So I'm wary of that as that people take that away as what I'm trying to suggest here. That said, territory is an extremely rare word in English until around this time. It's a word that's very rarely used in political theory, and the one of the things I found surprising in tracing this history of the concept of territory was just that there is no kind of canonical kind of major thinker who makes the argument that then everyone operates in the wake of them. It sort of isn't there, it isn't questioned, and then for some reason it just sort of flips, and then it's just an unassumed backdrop to the way that people think about those kinds of questions. And the German tradition of working through those fractured geographies seems to be the only place where it is explicitly theorised, because it makes much more sense in that tradition as the thing that is at contest between Leibniz working for the Duke of Hanover in response to the Holy Roman Empire in the wake of the Treaties of Westphalia. What is it that either Duke of Hanover have in that context? So there's a tradition there, and that slightly postdates these plays, but I think there might be something in this kind of, that the word is rare in Shakespeare for a reason. It's that it's a rare word in English at that point in time. globe and world, I mean, I haven't worked those through in this play. My immediate sense is that they wouldn't be as interesting as those other questions that I'm working through. And there was a deliberate ploy in using geopolitics to return geopolitics to the politics of Earth rather than the politics of the world or the globe, which is how it has now become. And so geopolitics has become that kind of division of the world and division of kind of sort of geostrategic kind of questions. I wanted to pull it back into a kind of what I think is a more rooted sense of those kinds of questions, I suppose.
That's what I was wondering, is if we take the world as a stage or the globe more, that, I mean, whether in a sense what you're saying is what that excludes is this other plot about the Earth or other, I mean, that seems to be sort of operating more subtle and unconscious.
Perhaps. I mean, I was wondering whether I could say anything about that kind of question, the world as a stage and so on, that wasn't just already done to death. Which isn't to say there couldn't still be interesting things to say about it, but I just didn't think I had anything interesting to say about it. Whereas I hoped on these questions there was something maybe that I could say that was a little different from the ways that I've read people writing on there.
May I invite you to expand a little bit on two points? One is this question, return to this question of the terrors of the Earth. Now, Lear doesn't know what he's going to do at that point, so he doesn't specify what those terrors might be. It sounds like a kind of proverbial imprecation, but what would we imagine to be exactly the terrors of the Earth if they were to be unleashed? And then the second thing, just to tell on the screen, could you say a little bit more about Richard II, to which you alluded? It seems to me to really turn on this inheritance. Gloucester, Richard imposing his rotten parchment bonds on the kingdom, accused of being England's landlord, that has to do with the right of succession, and we're told that if you remove that right, you created a kind of rupture in nature itself, because the whole world, you know, including the land, I imagine, if you think of it in seasonal terms, is governed by due sequence and succession. So it just seems to me that you know, I wish we could we stay for another hour while you talk about that?
If you ask me back in you know, X number of months, I might be able to do the Richard II justice. That's where I think I'm going to go next with this, because I do think there are, I mean, you know, you've given some instances of those kinds of questions, but it is that kind of, the abuse that Richard has done to the land of England through various mechanisms, the expulsion of Bolingbroke from the land.
Has gone beyond his remit to seize these lands?
Well, that seems to be one of the things that's at stake in terms of how people are reacting to him. But there's also the passage when he goes to Ireland and the kind of the, and I can't do the quotes, the relation that he has to this part of his kingdom from which he has been separated, and which there's this seditious uprising there, but then by the nature of him being there, he's unable to respond to the one that's going on back in England when Bolingbroke returns and so on. So I think there's all sorts of things to be done about that in Richard II, but I've not yet done it. It's where
this
I hope...
This is a stupid question.
No.
On my part. No, that what the stupid question is to follow. But doesn't King own the land?
Well, this is a real issue if you follow the political economy of land is the way to understand territory. And I think this is where orthodox Marxist accounts get themselves into a mess, because they seem to think that the relation of an individual's property to land, built up and up and up, accumulation of lots and lots of land, is the relation that the king or the sovereign has to their territory. Now, that to me is inadequate to understand it. I think it might be an element of it, and I wouldn't want to say that the political economy is unimportant to territory, but it seems to me to be radically insufficient to understand the relation of territory. And so the way I've tried to try to make sense of how territory has been understood at different times in different places, it is not to define territory differently, but to try to ask the questions and what kind of registers we need to ask these questions to understand how it has been understood. And the political economic is but one element of that. The others are the political strategic, the political legal, and the political technical, and the question of techniques, the question of the way that calculation makes possible a certain set of practices towards land surveying, cartography, navigation, these kinds of questions. And if you think those registers, then the political economic, while important, is only a part of that broader picture of understanding the question of territory. But I'm in danger of now going off on an answer to that. But that's how I've tried to understand territory. And I think that makes much more sense of the question of territory than any of those taken in isolation. The first question, the terrors of the earth. It would be, in one sense, to think he's just simply, as you sort of suggested, sort of, I'll rain hell on you. Just some kind of statement of just whatever there is, I will do in response to the way that you have betrayed and sung. But what's interesting in it, and I hesitated to actually do this in the talk, but it is an interesting question, is that relation between the words terror and territory, which has been worked through in various people that they share. The suggestion is that they share a Latin root. The territorium, the suffix aurium meaning surrounding or around, like crematorium, sanatorium, auditorium, where we are now, is the area around, and terra is the land or the earth. But then the other suggestion is that actually it relates to terrare, to frighten, to warn off, to scare away. The territorium is a place in which people are warned or expelled or excluded, they're frightened away from. So the terror and territory, which I exploited in my book on the War on Terror, but there's a question, but it seems to me that's much more plausible in practice rather than it is through the etymological argument. So the earth is in itself terrifying. Any kind of inclusion, exclusion, protection, expulsion, all of these are kind of acts of terrifying, or the terror in that respect. So that would be where I'd go if I was going to push that terror-earth question harder, the kind of the terror of geography. Terrifying geography.
This may be irrelevant, but personally, the Lear has a sort of geological imagination or a meteorological.
Or meteorological, absolutely.
Crack pictures, Germans. I mean, what does that mean? It has to do with upheavals and these are real terrors. There are earthquakes.
Right. And the fracturing of his relation to his land. I mean, that is the beginning division of the kingdom. There is that fracturing of the very land, of the earth, of the kingdom. So, yes, you can push that line, I think. But the meteorological, absolutely. And whether you could plausibly link the meteorological to what you're calling the geological in that fracturing would be interesting. Nick, and then Martin.
And just a short question, but it seems to me that one way of thinking about questions posed in many ways answered is between perhaps the crisis of the temporal moment. Particularly exemplified here in a rather anachronic play being in England, but nevertheless, of course, incorporating all these different inter-European stresses. But the tension between natural law and the law of nations, and the way in which these two things are more or less coming into being in and around this time, whereby we have both absolutism, and this stress for being perpetual and everlasting, but nevertheless, the quote up here, being pushed into the tumultuous sea, essentially, you know, either you changing forever or you're gone, and just the way in which the play helps capture, you know, internal and external strife. You have France and Burgundy, right, by far, far from settled Europe and all that. And thinking or pushing perhaps for the connection with the ongoing discussions.
I think succession is maybe the thing I'm interested in. I'm kind of beginning to realise how important succession is as a question to what I might be doing if I take this work on Shakespeare and territory further. Macbeth is a play about succession. I mean, it's a play about many other things, of course, but the question of succession is one of the things that's crucial in there. And we're just having a conversation about how Hamlet can be seen in that way as well. And obviously the history plays have shot through with the question of succession. But it's what do you succeed to, and the possession of what, you know, the kingdom that you end up possessing. And in international law, the idea of a successor regime that then is still party to the same international treaties as the previous one. So the decolonization process and the legal notion of uti possidetis, that what you have you will continue to possess, that a decolonizing country will succeed to the territory of the colonized division, which is why the boundaries in Africa Organization of African Unity in 1964 made this as a claim about how they were going to recognize those boundaries, even though they were arbitrary, even though they were colonial in position, as being the ones that would be the succession for the states that would follow. And this was a thing in the decolonization of South America, particularly. So the question of succession becomes not simply for me a temporal question, but it becomes a geographical question in terms of the heritage of those kinds of questions. And so for me, those become interlinked. And I think this is one of the things, perhaps not being trained as a geographer, but coming into geography, I've always, you know, with more training in history than I have in geography, the temporal and the spatial are always already intertwined rather than things that you can separate out and so on. And so I think that would be how I would work that kind of question through of thinking those issues. I mean, the France and Burgundy one is interesting because, again, it's anachronistic in terms of the, if you think of the supposed time in which King Lear is set, that these are quite modern designations for land relations to the nobility, which is an interesting question, I think, in terms of, again, what's going on in the play on those registers. I'm not sure I have much more to say at that moment. But Martin and then Elizabeth.
I have two questions that I hope are related. One is, I was struck that you didn't say much about the heath, and I was wondering what becomes of that. Is the importance of it that it's somehow neither land nor territory, or is it earth without being territory? And then the question that I have related to that is maybe too bald, but it seems to me that what you're heading towards is a suggestion that's something like this, that I was very struck by your discussion at the beginning of the play as not a stupid idea, but actually, until the moment with Cordelia anyway, necessary. It's politically wise. And I guess what I was wondering is, are you suggesting that, so I'm going to back up a bit. You said the king doesn't own the land, but you didn't say what the king does do in relation to land. And it seems to me what you're suggesting is that once territory enters in, what the king does is decide how the land will be divided.
The heath is interesting, and I mean, a lot has been written about that and in terms of the geography of the play and so on. And what I think is interesting about that is it effectively functions as if it is not possessed, that it hasn't fallen into either of those kind of relations of land and especially not territory. And I think this is one of the things that I mean, I find when teaching political geography, to try to get my students to grasp the idea that it wasn't simply that the world used to be divided with different boundaries between territories, but that actually the world didn't used to be divided into territories at all. Mm-hmm. And that you had a political geography that was much more focused on a human settlement, perhaps a town, spreading into what, in the rare instances that they do use it, the classical Latin writers call the territorium, the surrounding lands, often the agricultural lands, outside of the walls of the city, and that people then could retreat behind the walls at times of threat and so on. And then beyond that, the farmed lands and the next urban centre, there would be an awful lot of nothing, of wild, perhaps, is the category that would make most sense of that, of, you know, places like the heath, inhospitable, dangerous places. And you certainly get that in Beowulf, the idea that you have these isolated human settlements and that between them there is the dangerous outside. There's the marshlands, there's the place where Beowulf roams, the one who walks in those places. Sorry, where Grendel roams, rather than Grendel roams in those dangerous places outside of the place of human settlement. And I think what the heath does in part function in the play is as an instance of that kind of untamed land that hasn't, or untamed earth that hasn't been yet converted into either property land or political territory. And I think that that's an interesting thing, and you could do more with that. But it seems to me a lot of what's been said about the heath, I mean, a lot has already been said about the heath in those respects. What does the king actually possess? Status, I suppose, is the simple thing to say. And that one of the problems that I had in trying to read back into medieval and classical texts is not to assume that what they are talking about is something that makes sense in the same terms that we have now to make sense about those. And the relation between the ruler and the ruled, the people who owe them obedience, who owe allegiance, of relations, of structures, rather than owning the land and then having a relation to the people who happen to be in that bit of land, which is the much more modern way of thinking. And it's to try to break that suggestion that that's now that was the way to make sense of those kinds of relations. So I think it was much a relation of status, of structured relations, of the link between familial relations and kind of political allegiances, which of course is another question that's running through the play, of the idea of Lear's daughters being married to these different regional powers within this part of Britain and within France and Burgundy. So I think it's that relation that's important rather than the land relation.
Isn't the missing legal term which you had in your first quotation a lacula? Who are meaning
taking care of maintenance? Since
it
was
this, and you remember this bracketed passage that I told you.
The interest of territory, cares of state.
Cares of state. That is the translation, the legal term, kuma. So what the king has, he doesn't need the property. He is the one who is the guarantee which cares. And the legal term is the kuma. He carries the kuma, which has to do with the salvaca mundi. He's the vice. So to speak, he replaces God in his care for. This is kind of a legal construction, I take from Bracton.
No, Bracton's important. But the question that the late medieval political theorists are struggling with is the question of what is temporal power as opposed to eternal spiritual power. And that they struggle to articulate what temporal power is rather than what it is not. And that it is not the kind of power that the papacy lays claim to. And the temporal nature is that it is the power over people's life from birth until death. And that in time, temporal power becomes recoded effectively as territorial sovereignty, but in time. That's not the terms that are being used in those texts. And to try to push that too hard as the temporal power has that relation, I think is complicated. That said, Bracton is one example of this, but there are a number of other places where they try to articulate the scope of the power of a temporal ruler, and that it is the king in his kingdom and the emperor in the empire that they have these kind of vague geographical limits to their rule and to where they exercise their power, or what you could say that, you know, the cure of the thing that they're inheriting and the thing that they're taking forward and so on. But I think you know that can be pushed too far to say that that's already there in those texts. I don't think it is in that sense.
I think my question shifts from Professor Haberkamp's question about the earth is anachronic and Professor Gilman's question about succession in terms of sequence and land. And I think my question more generally is about space. And in terms of this slide here, whether or not the earth is something that can have a sequence in the way that something like territory can have succession. And so if there's something like an earth, just going to this slide here, that also has something like bid the winds blow the earth in the sea or swell the cold water above the mains. I'm not entirely sure in this passage or in Mir if there's always a sequence that follows one from the other in that hierarchical relationship in the same way that succession might happen in terms of territory. So I guess I'm wondering, and I'm not sure this is the right word, what that means for something like space. If the earth is something that has other parts composed of it, in the way that Professor Gilman was talking about a meteorological imagination for Lear, and what that meant in terms of Professor Haberkamp's question about anachronicity, if the earth is something like space that has component parts that are not necessarily in a sequence. So if that's something prior or simultaneous to something like territory, but if that's going on at the same time, and if that represents something that's out of sync or something different. So I guess if you were talking about how this was proceeding as a project for you in terms of succession, as opposed to looking at this slide, I was just wondering if those show something in terms of succession or sequence in terms
of that colon, something follows from it. Fretful element, follow. But then it's not so clear in terms of the earth, the sea, the main, the water, everything kind of goes haywire. So I guess that was just my question, if there are these different elements that seem very important for Lear specifically in terms of the land. And that's the question in terms of the sequence of succession. That your paper very interestingly brought up.
That's a fantastic question, and I don't think I can do very much in response to it, other than to say that that would be a kind of an extension of the argument of the different chronologies working in the play at different times, the sort of the background events and the context of those and the day-to-day action of the actual dialogue and staging. There is a different sense of time in terms of the elemental, in terms of nature, in terms of physical geography rather than the kind of the human geography element. And I think that would make for a really interesting reading. I'm not sure that's my project with it, but I think that is interesting. I mean, physical geographers have a very different sense of time to human geographers, which is something that I don't think has been... And geographers have not done as much maybe with the question of time as they maybe should do. And if you think of the... You know, I mean, Shakespeare's writing this beginning of the 17th century. I mean, this is really before the eruption of a notion of deep time in geological thought, in paleontology, and the challenge to the kind of the biblical narrative and so on. And so time is greatly compressed in the understanding of the time he's writing. You know, that it's a sort of 6,000-year chronology, and but human and the physical geography chronologies, there's only the... Was it 5 days in the Bible? 6 days difference between when the world is created and when humans are created? But that then pulls apart in through the course of the 17th century, through the discovery of fossils and the work on fossils and the kind of... You know, Leibniz's writings on the Protogaea, the early Earth, are a moment in that kind of story. And that has a very important rupturing effect in terms of not simply that the biblical narrative is a peculiar one, but the human's relation to the earth is radically transformed, because that their span of life on the earth is but now a fraction rather than the great proportion of the earth's history. I think you could do something quite interesting with thinking through those kinds of questions, but I hadn't thought about it in terms of this play. I hadn't thought about it in terms of, you know, another project I have on fossils, for instance, and, you know, though, as a fossils as a philosophical problem, for instance. That's a great question. I'll think on that. Thank you.
May I take you, just to follow up on Alexandre briefly, can I take you back to the territory slide at the beginning? Lear seems to be very specific about what he's giving up here in the folio edition. And where's the parenthesis? With the care of Rulia. Okay, so he, I now we now divest us both. That is, both. Okay, so you're expecting two things to follow, but you get three.
Right.
Rule, yeah. Interest of territory, and care of state. Now, the only way to make sense grammatically of the both is to read it as, we now divest ourselves of both of the characteristics of rule, namely, interest of territory and care of state. The precision of it, I mean, it seems like there's some kind of precision here that for a grammarian at least is a little bit blurred by the both. So, in other words, does rule incorporate or is defined by those two other things, or are there three separate things of which rule is one?
I'm not
a lawyer, I know.
No, that's right. I think I'd read it as the two elements or the two parts of rule.
Interest and care.
If this is the structure, the Latin structure, the Latin structure of the et et in the legal texts. Very often they just put one et in the middle, but normally it's implied et as a legal kind of formula. The one and the other, and that is exactly the one and the other, both refers to this. And so I'm completely right. It means both of rule. I mean, the two sides of rule. And one is et territory, et cura.
That said, and I'm thinking back to what I actually said, and I know that I pulled that in and then said the question of rule, territory, and state.
Yeah.
So I probably did play with both the three terms and the two terms. But in a way, that's what's nice about it, is a kind of a potential ambiguity in the phrase. But I think that's right, that it's the both of rule, one of which is to do with territory and one of which is to do with state, and the interest of territory, which is the one that also comes in Henry VI, part two, I think, as well as the interest of territory here. So what is the stake, the political, legal relation to the territory, rather than the merely political economic property?
I think we should be going for 2:30.